Hi, this is Julie Valamont, and welcome back to ContraPulse. In this episode, we have the follow-up interview with Charlie Pilser. After we spoke at NEFA, we wanted to continue our conversation, and so I was fortunate to be able to have a visit with him last May at his home in Tacoma Park, Maryland. We spent a while chatting about contra music and his experiences as a dance musician, and he played some piano, and I got to see his music library a little bit. In our conversation, we got to some of the big questions about how the contra scene music is changing, and got a little bit of Charlie's take on those changes. Without any further ado, here's part two. So welcome to part two of our interview with Charlie Pilser.
I have no idea what I said in part one.
Oh, I do. I remember everything. Charlie and I had a wonderful chat at NEFA, which was actually a really great place to talk about all this stuff. There was contra music in the background and people walking by, and a lot of the people we were talking about happened to be at NEFA. And so in part one of the interview, we talked a little bit about how Charlie started playing for contras and kind of like where you learned, and, you know, you kind of learned in the DC area. And I love the story that you kind of just, your band kind of made it up together.
That's right.
Which is so great. Do you play different tunes differently depending on their genre?
Absolutely. Yeah. No question about it. And in fact, my taste in medleys are, I keep like tunes with like. Mm-hmm. So it would be really, really weird for me to do a medley of Rock That Cradle Joe with St. Anne's Reel with Bus Stop. I just wouldn't do that.
Right. Why not? I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate because I am like you. I don't mix genres.
I know exactly why not.
Yeah.
Because if you mix the genres too not, then it all becomes just a beige melange, that there's no distinction. So for me, I want to put an Irish tune with an Irish tune, a Quebec tune with a Quebec tune, an old-timey tune, southern tune with a southern tune, and actually accentuate the stylistic differences, because that gives flavor to the music. So at least for the players, if not for the dancers, different tunes sound different, even if they don't know why it sounds different. The kind of thing I would do to back up an old-timey tune just isn't going to be the same as I would do for a French-Canadian tune.
Right. So sometimes I feel like there's a logistical reason, too, for putting those tunes together, because often you pick an old-timey tune for a dance because of the phrasing of the dance and the groove of the tune. And so if you
And the moves.
Exactly. And so that old-timey groove and the way you play piano would work for one kind of dance. But then if you switch that groove halfway through to like a smooth, flowy Irish tune, that just doesn't make any sense.
Exactly.
It wouldn't fit the dance as well. The one time I do mix genres is when I'm playing medleys, like the NEFA style medley that's like 25 minutes long.
Yeah, but that's because you have six different callers doing six.
Exactly.
And they're accentuating the changes is more important, because you're trying to give clues to the dancers to say, oh, hey, pay attention, here's a new dance.
Exactly. So it feels like instead of 1 8- or 10-minute experience, it feels like six different 5-minute experiences all tacked on.
Actually, they're 3-minute experiences.
Oh, yeah, my math is off. Yeah, six times through. You're right. 3 minutes. Yeah. So many little 3-minute experiences. What a funny thing we do. Why do we do that? It's so funny.
Yeah. I mean, a NEFA medley is theoretically 18 and a half minutes long, because it's 6 times 6 plus 1. So it's 37 times.
Right.
At a nominal 120 clicks to the minute, it takes 30 seconds. Once through the dance. Actually, it takes 32 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe it's a little bit long, because maybe you're going at 116 rather than 120. But on the average, you can figure that out.
Yeah. I mean, like, contra music, I've been thinking about this, like, as a genre, what is contra music these days?
Anything you want it to be.
Well, it's a funny tradition, right? Our tradition is that we take tunes from a whole bunch of other traditions and then play them kind of however we want
to. All right, so here's one for
That's a funny tradition.
So if you heard a dance going.
Yep.
What band?
I mean, nowadays. is it could be any of those. Back then, it could have been Wild Asparagus. Could have been Great Bear. Like the first few bands that did that a lot. But now any band would do that. You know, I do that. Like,
yeah.
Nowadays, I couldn't tell you who that is, which is
interesting. Well, I'm thinking Great Bear.
Right, exactly. 20 years ago, or maybe more like 10, 15 years ago, there were only a few bands who you would immediately think of.
Yeah.
And that's interesting.
And that might be the whole thing. There might not be a melody to it.
Yeah. On one extreme, you know. Like Wild Asparagus would do some riff-based stuff, but generally there's a tune. Great Bear took that to the place of like, what's the tune for?
Right.
The tunes show up. They especially show up in the beginning of the medley when the caller's still teaching the dance and the dancers need that phrasing. But then the tune might like go away and not come back again. And then you forget it was ever there, which is interesting.
But then I'll do fun things like I'll watch the dance, you know, and you'll see, you know, forward, you know, lines on the side, forward and back, you know, and I'll accentuate where they meet up in the middle, or I'll accentuate, you know, on a balance.
Right.
You know, that you kind of want to get that little pulse.
Right. You're watching the phrasing and you're kind of spiking different moves.
Or say a bounce of the Petronella turn. You leave the beat out and you let the dancers put the beat in.
That's fun.
And then if they catch on, you know, all of a sudden you'll do something, you leave a little beat out, and they'll really try to stomp hard to fill in the missing beat.
Yeah. Which I love. I love those moments of connecting with the dancers. That's to me when it becomes magical.
Well, I always watch the dancers.
Yeah.
Well, how can you tell what you're doing if you aren't watching the dancers? If you have your head down beside your piano, you might as well stay at home.
Right. I think, unfortunately, playing with sheet music, you know, there are folks who do it, but it can often distract you. Your full attention isn't on the dancers at that point when you have to watch the music.
Right.
And so it's not a judgmental thing that I'm saying.
Like, no,
you
only have
had to do it, but
you only have so much split brain capability.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's part of also the pickup nature of contrabands that people are throwing tunes at each other they don't always know. And so sometimes it's really great to get out the Portland or the Fiddler's Repertoire or whatever. You know, it's great, but it means you can't watch the dancers.
Yeah. Julie, can you talk while you play?
Yes, if I'm playing Boomchuck. Boomchuck for me is like this rhythm. If I'm playing just basic company, if I'm doing complicated riffs, or if I'm doing, I do a lot of things with two hands differently. Like I'll play a counter melody line with my right hand and a bass line with my left hand. I can't talk while I do that easily. What about you?
So if I'm playing any sort of regular accompaniment to a tune I know, I can actually have a conversation.
Yeah.
If I'm trying to follow chords on a piece that I don't really know and trying to make sense about how the chords flow one into another, so I have like a piece of sheet music in front of me and I'm trying to listen what's going on, then, you know, the speech capabilities go out the window.
Right?
Because it devolves to grunts.
Yeah. Yeah, and also I have my listening brain. I can't talk when I'm listening in the same way. Yeah, it's funny. Like, I know a fiddler who can talk while he fiddles if the fiddle is down here. But if he moves it up to his mouth, he can't. If he moves the fiddle up here, he can't talk anymore.
Why would he move the fiddle up here? That's on the wrong side.
Well, whatever. Okay, I'm not a fiddler. But if he has it in proper violin position, he can't talk while he plays. If he brings it down here, he can.
Oh, how interesting.
Playing exactly the same thing. But it's just neurologically, it's really interesting. And so, like, you're multitasking a lot as a contra player because you're watching the dancers, you're working with the caller. I don't think callers always realize when we can talk and when we can't. And they'll often come and talk to me right as we're about to do some tune switch or something that I really have to be paying attention. And then I'm like, I just hold up one finger, like, just give me 30 seconds. Yeah. You're paying attention to your bandmates.
Yeah, you're paying attention to bandmates.
You're watching
say I'm at Glen Echo, okay, in Washington, D.C. So the typical way it sets up there is a little grand piano, a little short one. That tends to be stage left, all the way on the left-hand side of the stage, as you look at the dancers.
Mm-hmm.
Then your lead is usually next to you, although not always. The next musician. So if I'm playing, say, in a band of four.
Mm.
There's a band I play with where I'll play, there's a mandolin player next to me, the lead fiddler is next, and the flute's on the end. But so I'll sit there and I'll have half an eye on the dancers, an ear on what's going on next to me, the other half an eye overlooking at the caller on the other side, and the piano, and my third eye is looking at the piece of music because we play all these tunes that are so weird that nobody knows them.
Huh. Why? Who picks them? I don't want to derail your point, though. Go ahead.
Well, in that particular case, the flute... All right, so this particular group is... oddly enough, all four of us actually went to music school and actually had, you know, are versed in real-life classical music training at one time, although I haven't played any in years, so I don't know if I count anymore. But I did have the background. So each of us have probably been playing our instruments 50 years, or at least playing music, I've sort of been playing music seriously since I was like 13, so that would be 55 years ago now. So the four of us, sort of collectively have 200 years of music training, and we've toured, played in lots and lots of places, not just in the U.S. So there's a huge amount of playing capability in this group. So the flute player plays all these chromatic tunes that, in keys of B flat and things with weird changes and these really gnarly tunes that you never see come up because nobody else can play them.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the contra tradition. It's funny to wrap your head around a tradition that, we play some, what we call traditional contra tunes, a lot of them are New England tunes, but more and more there's tunes that are becoming new traditional, like Catharsis and Flying Home to Shelley and Bus Stop and modern tunes that everyone knows and plays. And then it's also totally traditional to play random tunes that we make up that are really weird. It's traditional to borrow tunes from France or Ireland or Scotland or old time tunes.
So in this group, one of the sets, we borrow these tunes from the 1500s. Which were dance tunes in the 1500s. We have one where we have, now this is a mixed genre, so we'll have a Carey polka and then a rota from 1480 or whatever it is, and then back to another Carey polka.
So when you're picking tunes, what is the common denominator that makes a tune a good dance tune? Because you're thoughtful about the tunes you play.
Well, it's very interesting. In this particular group, we have diverging opinions about what makes a good tune. What I think makes a good tune is something that at its very heart is rhythmic. No matter what else happens in the tune, there's a rhythmic component to the tune, whether it's the melody or the accompaniment or the second melody or, because if you don't have something defined, I mean, even deconstructed tunes have a rhythmic component. In fact, they're nothing but rhythmic components.
Like riffs and things like
that. Yeah. But when you take all the rhythm out, then the dancers have a hard time.
Right. Because they have less notes and stuff to them. They need some rhythmic underpinning to make a mark.
The other thing that makes a good contra dance tune, to me, is one that's phrased. Because if you think about contra dance moves, they move in, four measures or two measures or eight measures, every move has a certain number of beats that it fills up. Some are expandable. A swing can be short, a swing can be long. You can have a half hay, you can have a full hay, you can have a walk around, which is kind of a quarter hay if you think about it. And depending on the dance, you want a phrase. You want music to phrase it to the dance so that the dancers know where the next move begins, even if the caller doesn't prompt it. Even if the dancers don't know that the music is cueing them. And it's funny because there's a trend in some dance writing where, to me, the dances that don't work as well, the ones that kind of ignore that a little bit, where they start kind of stringing moves together a little arbitrarily. And maybe they cross the phrase.
So the dance has to have good flow, whatever good flow means.
Right.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So there's a huge advantage, in a way, if, as a band, if you work with the same caller a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the two of you can kind of meld stuff that fits. And there are tunes that work better for some dances than others. And when I'm playing, if I see the tune's not working, it's like, you know, they talk about calling it audible. You just pass the line down to the next musician. We're getting out of this tune.
Yeah. Yeah.
Forget this medley. We're going somewhere else right. altogether because this is not working.
Fail. We've all been there.
Yeah. Don't stay there.
Yeah.
Because when you're playing for a contra dance, what you're doing is functional music. This is music for a purpose. You know, so if you play for a concert, it almost doesn't matter what you play if you can convey some sort of compelling feeling or emotion, or you paint a musical picture that you can vary things, you can be rubato, you know, change the tempo, you can slam stuff together. And that's all to keep the interest of the audience. But if you're playing for a contra dance, if you can't play music that works for making for a good dance experience, why are you here?
Mm-hmm. So any tune you pick has to fulfill those basic requirements.
Exactly.
And then after that, it's all flavor and fun and variety of moods and textures. But it has to have that foundation. So then what about the old adage, any tune for any dance?
Not true.
Yeah. This is your interview, not mine, you know, but like changing choreography, I think the choreography has become a lot more specialized. So callers are asking for more demanding things than they used to, in terms of bands have to have we could play caller bingo of what a band caller's gonna ask us for in a night. I'll put slinky jigs like right, you know, in the middle, happy reels, something driving, you know, they all
want. Yeah, but it's interesting. Sometimes what they think of as a slinky jig, it's not what I think of as a slinky jig.
Right.
You know, that they'll say smooth, you know. Smooth for them may not be smooth for me.
Right. Right, and then there's tunes that can sound smooth depending on how you accompany them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or how the fiddle player plays them.
Right, it really very much depends on, which is why, do you look at the card at all when you work with callers?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes, because it'll give a sense. You know, if I look and I see, oh, there's a figure eight, or there's a mad robin, or there's a hay. That would give me one idea for tunes. If I see it's balance and then this and balance and then that and then balance and, you know, balance to an ocean wave with a, you know, then a, mm-hmm. You know, roll away with a half sachet, I'm blanking on the tune. The jig.
The jig. I don't think I can help you.
Royal Moore.
Oh, yes. That jig.
Yeah. You know, so balance, roll away, balance, roll back. I mean, that's a whole different kind of tune.
Yeah.
There are contra dances that are conscious that are sort of squares, but they're really conscious.
Mm-hmm.
But then all of a sudden there's a square move in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, conscious of the cross trail through, and it's like, what?
But that suggests
playing a whole different kind of tune.
Yeah.
You know, are you going to play the tune half fast or are you going to play it lickety-cut?
Uh-huh.
Those are the two clog speeds.
So what would make a tune good for that kind of dance in your mind? Like, what are the characteristics of a tune that would be that? I mean, we all know it, right? Like, old-time tunes are good. Is it because they don't have a lot of notes? Is it because of how their rhythms go?
Well, actually, old-time tunes have lots of notes. They don't have a lot of rhythmic changes.
Oh, interesting. Say more.
Okay, so if you think about old time fiddling,
mm-hmm.
the big thing in the old time fiddling is their little shuffle, you know, dump a 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 dump. no matter what tunes they're playing, that their whole bow is kind of doing that thing, which has kind of an impetus. You know, and the way you write the tune, the old tunes are written to promote that feel, that drive.
So it's like rhythmic engine that's underneath the whole tune.
And so, you know, the dancers move to rhythmic engine. There are other tunes that I call like chug tunes, you know, where you know, you kind of dance along, but you aren't moving fast. It's just...
just get in a groove.
You get in a groove, you know, just...
yeah.
You know, and these are tunes that don't have... what's a good... I'm trying to think, what's a good chug tune? You know, they don't have a big... there'll be things like Dorian tunes, you know, where there'll be, you know, a bunch of D minor, then a C major chord, you know, just...
how about something like Growling and Grumbling?
Yeah, Growling and Grumbling. That's a good example of a chug tune.
Yeah. As soon as the fiddler was switching that tune, the whole rhythm changes
right
for the set.
Then they're trance tunes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, you know, they tend to be, you know, more flowing, where the dancers just, you know, they just kind of continually flow from one thing to the other, but they aren't like chugging along, they're flowing along. Mm-hmm. A lot of English tunes could be trance mm-hmm. tunes. Classic, what you think of as classic New English is like you go back to Swinging on the Gate or Dominion Reel or Teetotalers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have yet a different kind of beat where, you know, they're kind of almost, you know, where things are deliberately stepping one after another, but you aren't in a groove as much as you are in motion. They're marches, you know, take like Shadrach's Delight with, you know, it has the down the hall, you know, four in line down the hall, you know, turn, single, come back. Marches fit good for that because mm-hmm. that's the kind of motion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think if I look at a card, that's the kind of things I'm looking for. You know, I say, oh, if I see, you know, a marchy kind of move, you know, or... all right, so example, all right, other moves about how I would match a tune. So a figure where, like, you know, you left Alaman halfway, go to the next, right Alaman to the next, third one, turn all the way around, come back, swing. Is that Steve Zakon Anderson's dance?
So 333.
Yeah, 333, whatever that
is.
Yeah,
whatever that is, yeah.
I think that's what that does. You know, when you go around that.
There's a lot of this. And then
yeah. Like, well, and then, so you think about that. That's the same as doing, circle left and right in a square dance. Meet your partner halfway, you know, keep on going.
Yeah.
Grant, you know.
Like functionally, it's the same.
And so that you tend to think of the dance the same way.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
You don't think about it that way.
Well, I don't know how I think about it.
I mean, so if I look at that, I'm trying to figure out what tune is going to go with this dance.
Mm-hmm.
And then some ways it's the other way around. Sometimes we'll just pick a dance. I'll tell the caller. I mean, I'll tell them ahead of time. We want to end with these two
mm-hmm.
medleys. Here's the kind of tunes they are. Let's figure out some dances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. While I'm sitting here listening to you, I'm just thinking, like, I can't imagine Bob McQuillan talking about trance dances and chug tunes and, you know, like...
totally not.
Yeah.
Okay, but think about... all right, so think about, to a large part, what his repertoire was.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in, call it the last 30 years that he played.
Mm-hmm.
So when he and Pete Colby and April Limber played,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, as the New England tradition, and then it was Jane Orr Zukowski
mm-hmm.
and Mac and Deanna Styles, mm-hmm. and the Rhythm Rollers, who's Kathy Whitesides mm-hmm. and Laurie Anders, and Mac, an awful lot of those tunes were Mac tunes.
Right.
And all Mac tunes have a certain classic style to it. You know, he didn't write trance tunes.
And that 1-5-1 cadence at the end and like the whole thing. Yeah. Yeah, they're, you know, they're
here, classic. You can swing your camera around. I mean, you know, there's all my little MacBooks all like.
Yeah.
Well, you could take a photograph of them, but you see they're, you know.
Yeah, you got them all right there.
They're all right there.
Yep.
And so, no, I mean, his was the opposite way around. And you should go talk to some callers.
Mm-hmm.
It's my guess, my hypothesis, that if you were a caller knowing you were going to go call a dance with Bob McQuillan playing piano, there's a good chance you would set up your dance so it would work with Bob McQuillan tunes and it would work with all classic four on the floor New England tunes. And you don't worry about old timey tunes. You don't worry about Quebec tunes. You don't worry about trance tunes.
Right.
Because he didn't vary the style. But would that be popular with contemporary dancers?
Well, right. That's
with
the
some
question.
It would be, with some it wouldn't. Some people like classic stuff like that. But when you know, if you look at McQuillan, and I have to say he really sort of fell into a category of one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's only one McQuillan.
Yeah.
I honestly, who would fall into that category now? Of people I'm trying to think of who's performing now, who falls in that category of being so classic.
You know, I think Rodney Miller has that persona.
Rodney is probably one.
Although it's ironic to call him classic, because I think a lot of his reputation was built on the new things that he did in his fiddling style.
Yeah, but it's funny, if you listen to Airplane now, it's still an excellent record, but it sure is not the cutting edge thing it was at the time.
Well, because now everyone's doing it, you know?
And more,
yeah.
Yeah, Rodney, Dudley.
Yeah. Dudley's mostly doing more barn dance kind
more
of things.
More barn dances.
These days.
Yeah, he used to be more in this kind of the mainstream. When you go back and you listen to the Canterbury Orchestra records and what he used to call to compared to what he does now.
Yeah, he either chose to move or ended up moving or some combination of those things into this niche that
I think it's a very deliberate choice on his part.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to be the iconic old man of New Hampshire.
And that's his wheelhouse, in a sense, you know, like going around and, I mean, modern callers have to collect choreography and stay hip with all that stuff, and they have to always be like...
Or make up dances or whatever,
and they have to be working with certain bands, and, you know, I think he's got his thing that is iconic, like you said.
And he does, you know, he was doing 200 to 250 gigs a year, you know, he's working more than anybody. Who else do I think of now? I mean, there are people over the years, you know, when you think of callers, you start with Ralph Page and Ted Sinella and Tony Salatin and who else would I recall? I mean, now Tony Parks, you know, is still, you know, been around for years, still excellent caller. I just think he's so good. Who are some of the players who've been around all those years? Donnie Ebert is around, George Wilson, Vince O'Donnell, you know, who's an icon in the Boston area and not all that well known outside.
Right. Randy Miller is another person.
Yeah.
Who, I think he plays less conscious these days.
Right.
Than he used to, but...
You know, but he's a great resource on tunes, because he didn't...
He wrote the book.
He wrote the book. He's written a couple of books.
And he was one of those people, like, actively bringing Irish tunes into the New England repertoire and things like that. They kind of... It's so funny. I just think it's so weird that we just assume we can, like, hey, let's play this tune from this country and this country and this country. What a weird tradition that is. It's so normal for country musicians to do it now. We don't even think about it.
Right.
But it's because there were people who were, I mean, tunes move around anyway. Like, as people immigrate, they bring the tunes. So it's not like these have all lived in New England forever. There were, you know, English and French and Irish and Scottish tunes just coming to, and Cape Breton tunes coming to New England because people moved here. But I think that's different from, like, actively just going out and listening to an album and being like, let's play this for a concert dance.
Hey.
And that is, like, totally the new normal. Let's see. Are there any other things we want to touch on before we wrap up? Because we had a nice little jaunt into the hinterlands thing.
So we go back to piano. So what more do you want to know about piano?
I'm curious maybe to have you talk about the festival orchestra a little bit while we're on that topic.
Okay.
You've been leading the festival orchestra for a number of years now.
Yeah.
And
it's quite an honor. Keep thinking one year they're going to say, okay, Charlie, you've had enough. Time to put you out to pasture.
Who was leading it before you?
Who was leading it before me?
Deborah, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, the people who are leading these days, Lisa does it, Debbie Knight.
Yeah, Roaring Jelly. She has a whole band that's like a permanent festival orchestra.
Right. Bruce Rosen led it for a while, but he decided he'd rather play piano than lead the orchestra.
You guys are playing it first.
And I'm trying to think of, like, who led the festival.
Well, how long have you been leading it? It's probably been a while.
5 years, maybe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, not as long as I thought.
I've been playing in it longer than that.
Yeah.
But
wasn't Lisa the one before?
I'm trying to think. All right, so
this wouldn't be that hard for me to find out.
No, wouldn't it be that hard? So here's the thing, that the big session I'm always thinking is the one that's the last one, you know,
the Sunday afternoon. Big thing when they merry-go-round.
So for years and years and years, you know, I mean, that was, the festival orchestra was led. The key players was Bob McQuillan was always playing piano. Mm-hmm. For years at first, you know, it was April Limber, mm-hmm. you know, and Pete, until they passed away, you know, they would be the key. And then for a lot of years is Jane Orzechowski and then Vince.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so in recent years the combination has been Vince has been playing fiddle and Bruce Rosen plays mm-hmm. piano.
Amy Cann's always there.
Yeah. And now in the last few years I've been making up the medleys and
mm-hmm.
figuring it out. And you know, and I actually put thought in, you know, and I write the callers ahead of time and kind of figure out you know, what dances the callers want. And I've been, you know, people are pulling a lot of contemporary tunes. I've sort of gone backwards, you know. It's like, all right, let's do some Ralph Page tunes. Like, here's a Ralph Page medley. Let's do a McQuillan medley. Let's find some of those tunes that people haven't played. I mean, in a way, you could play the same tunes year after year, you know, and people would get better. But for me, there's a multiple challenge in picking the tunes and making up arrangements. Is you want to do something that's fun for the musicians,
mm-hmm.
that's fun for the dancers, and primarily is functional for all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a year or two ago, I used Claude Ginsberg's tune, Oddville Cupola. And, you know, I handed that out to the festival orchestra, and everybody goes, what? You know, and I talked to Bob Isaacs. You know, I said, well, okay, so this is a 64-bar tune. You got to go through the tune, the dance twice to go once through the tune. He says, I got it. He says, you don't even need a second tune. I just want you to play this one tune. And it's this whole kind of trance thing. You know, it's this sort of odd tune.
Yeah.
And, you can talk about tunes. So the thing that makes Oddville interesting is they're quarter note tunes and they're eighth note tunes.
Right.
Most tunes are eighth note tunes.
Right.
This is a quarter note tune. Right. The great thing about quarter note tunes, they're accessible to everybody.
In terms of your technical skill.
Yeah, you don't have to have a lot of technical skill to be able to play quarter note tunes effectively and do.
Right. I mean, it's true that like a lot of the traditional New England tunes we think of are actually quite hard to play when you finally sit down to play them.
Some of them are impossible to play.
Well, like President Garfield's Hornpipe or something. Like,
right.
You know, but a lot of them are, some of them are beautifully simple, but a lot of them take, they're not actually easy to say. They sound simple, and that makes you think that they play simply, but they don't. Anyway, it's an interesting observation.
Yeah. I mean, tunes that are around, I mean, something like Little Burnt Potato, mm-hmm. it's hard because it has that little twiddle. You know, dee-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, it's this little chromatic twiddle. That's part of the tune, but it actually makes it hard if you have trouble sliding your finger on the half steps on a fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has an odd string cross too. If you don't play the fourth finger, E is hard. You know, it's.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, but so you know, so if I teach a beginning band class, a lot of tunes I pick. I'll pick quarter note tunes
mm-hmm.
because they're easier to teach and people don't have to be real. They don't need a lot of technical chops to be able to make effective, fun sounding melodies.
Right.
And, you know, then you just think for the festival, I just think of spontaneous things, odd things to do, you know.
Right. Your
play
tricks.
This chord, do this, you know, stop here, listen to the.
Is that stuff more dramatic than what you would do as a regular piano player? Would you do that stuff if you were in a band and, like, you know?
It all depends on the dance, on who I'm playing with.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it is effective because it's a big band.
Right. And because there's a lot of dancers. And because it's Sunday at NEFA and all these things
exactly.
that go into it. Yeah.
I mean, some of the tricks, like some of the harmonic tricks are things that I already know because of stuff I've done. And I know, oh, this is a cool sounding thing. It's like, play this. And they'll go, what? Just do what I say. Play that.
Yeah.
And then everybody goes, oh.
Yeah. I love that you're picking these older tunes that wouldn't, there's a bunch of these kind of New England tunes or French Canadian tunes that have become in the New England style, like Gaspé Reel and all those things. They're kind of traditional now, you know, and they don't get played otherwise. Like, if they didn't show up, like, the Flurry also has a roots band, but it's less traditional tunes than the festival orchestra. But aside from some places like this, these tunes don't get played that often in a big festival.
I play them all. Well, I don't know. Yeah. I play them all the time.
Right. But where do most concert dancers go where they would be exposed to these tunes?
Oh, to things like Neffens.
Yeah. So I think it's really great that they're still
playing. I don't know. I mean, if you go to a dance weekend, are you going to hear those tunes? Well,
no.
That's why I don't get hired.
Well, I mean, this is the crux of what this whole project is about, is like, musicians, we do what we want for ourselves. Like, we play music, hopefully, that is musically satisfying. We also are being respectful, at least trying, most of the musicians are also trying to be respectful of a tradition that we are inheriting and passing on.
And some are more respectful and more knowledgeable.
Right, than others. And the beauty is that it doesn't have to matter if you know about the tradition as long as you're playing for good concert dance. But enough people have to know about the tradition. But then there's also, we have to do what the dancers want or we don't get hired. And that's tricky. And there have been some, I mean, I don't want to go too into personal territory, but there, you know, it's interesting when, like, there are these icons in the world who have devoted a lot of their lives to this tradition, to contra dancing and stuff, and then all of a sudden they find they're no longer relevant. And that happens, you know, but...
Okay, so I know exactly the thing. So, as you know, I played for your... I don't know, maybe I said this in the last... I bet I said this in the last interview. You know, Spellemaner, you know, when we first played years ago, it was, oh, we're ruining Danish folk music.
Right.
And then, you know, 40 years later, thank goodness for Spellemaner, they're preserving Danish folk music. And we haven't changed at all.
Right.
But, you know, the whole world's drifted past us.
Right. Yeah, which is interesting. And so Ralph Page Dance Weekend is so important for me for these tunes to have like a home. And I notice the style of dancing is different in Ralph Page. That's kind of the things that make me wonder. Is it the
tunes? Actually, I've never been there.
It's wonderful. It's one of my favorite festivals ever. Yeah. And the dancing is amazing, but in a totally different way than people think of amazing dancing. I think people, when they think of amazing dancing, they think of like dipping and flourishes. And I think Ralph Page dancing is amazing because everybody is on time and they all look out for each other.
Yeah. It's effortless. I mean, for that matter, I've never been to the dance flurry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a circle that, you know, I don't exist in.
Yeah. And so, you know, you get these like dance weekends, and the kind of music they want for dance weekends is different than the kind of music that you want for your community dance.
Depends on who's booking the community dance.
Right, or who's booking the dance weekend, I guess. You know.
And dance weekends come and go. There's a local DC area. Well, actually, there are two local DC area weekends that totally struggled this spring. One canceled and one went ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if either one will even try to self-assemble for next year.
Yeah. What do you think that is from?
Well, a couple of things.
I know this would be a whole other interview. So.
Yeah, it's a whole other interview. Okay. I mean, all right, so here's a good topic for you to ask other people and their views. So I think dancing in general, more specifically contra dancing, is cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it all but died out in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for Ralph Page and Ted Sinella,
mm-hmm.
you know, and eventually Dudley, it wouldn't survive. It wouldn't have survived. You know, I'm sure other people have documented that's a lot better than in my confused head. But those guys, you know, those really, Ralph and Ted, I'm trying to think, maybe Tony. And Tony, who else preserved it? You know, but there, mm-hmm. there almost were no contradancing. You know, it didn't begin flourishing early until the latter half of the 70s and the 80s,
mm-hmm.
you know, then it peaked. And now it seems to be on the decline again.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's in more places. There are more dances you could go, but I think a lot of dances everywhere struggling. I mean, think about the fact that, you know, the Monday night dance at Scout House, how many years has that been going on?
A long time, but it's very different now than during the peak of the Yankee ingenuity.
Exactly.
Days.
And why is that? People age out. The next generation is doing something different, you know.
And there's often a bunch of factors that they all play together.
Greenfield, Massachusetts, you know, David's Friday Night Dances had huge draws, you know, and they've been, you know, they were on the decline. But, you know, but then other dances at the Greenfield Grange are doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, there's a little bit of a missed generation mm-hmm. that I don't quite get. So if you think of contra dancers, to me, of course, they're all baby boomers because that's my peer group.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fairly active group of millennials.
Mm-hmm.
Who were raised by the
baby boomers.
Yeah, and in some places they reject it, and in some places they don't. But I think there's less Gen Xers involved.
Yeah, I don't see a lot of people in my age group dancing.
Of course, a bunch of them have families and
right,
jobs.
Right, it's the childbearing years and the adulting years.
But on the other hand, things like family camps are, you know, still seem to be successful, but other camps are not as successful.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because there are more camps, it's more spread out. You know, at one time, the only camps were like you know, if you didn't go to Pinewoods, where else was there? Well, there were no Bay Area camps. There was no camps in Michigan. There was nothing in Texas.
Right.
You know, there was nothing in the Pacific Northwest. And then, you know, things have gotten more expensive, so that for some dancers, taking a week off to go to a week-long camp is not as attractive as it might be to take off 2 weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And where are they going to go? Well, they're not going to go to the traditional weekends, because that's where the baby boomers are. Let's go dance with ourselves. So we'll go make our own weekend and we'll go dance mm-hmm. at X, Y, or Z. I mean, think about where you get hired, you know, where Buddy System gets hired.
Right.
Who runs them? Younger people, older people, are they more traditional, long?
A variety. A lot of...
more newly organized camps, I would think.
Well, a lot of the dance weekends seem to be mostly run by baby boomers who... we play at some communities where they're actively trying to recruit. They're like, look, here's the young person on the committee, you know? Where they're actively trying to recruit younger people. Some weekends are run by younger people. Weekends that are specifically youth-focused tend to try to book up-and-coming bands, and we're not.
All a good thing.
Yeah, which is wonderful, but we're not up-and-coming, so we don't actually end up playing for those events, yeah. Which is pretty funny.
No, you're up-and-camed.
You're up-and-camed. Yeah, now we're down and went.
No, I'm down and went.
Funny.
Julie, I
like this phrase, down and went. I'm in a down and went band. It's the opposite of up and coming. Well, I just wanted to appreciate that.
Well, I don't know about you.
For a second.
Well, no, it's clear I don't know about you. For a dance weekend, you know, for like a 3-day event, I don't recall the last time I was hired.
Yeah.
Can you recall, Cecily? No, there's been some others, but...
but not very many.
Not very many. And certainly nothing probably within the last 20 years.
Yeah, why is that? You know, and...
you'd have to ask the dance organizers.
Right. This is a whole... this we could turn this into a whole other, you know, interview.
A whole other topic.
Yeah, this is for someone else to explore, but...
yeah.
My job is to think about how the music...
maybe it's it. Maybe my music's too square. My music's too square, and I'm not iconic enough.
Oh, I don't know though. Right, because if you're iconic, they keep you along.
Right.
Is a living fossil. I don't mean that in a denigrating way, but that's kind of, you know, you become the horseshoe crab of your generation.
Right.
So let me ask you this: what do you think people will be playing for Contras in 30 years?
Same thing they're playing now. In other words, what I mean by that is there are certain tunes, certain traditional tunes will continue to stay around.
Uh-huh.
Chorus Jig and Money Musk and Swing on a Gate and Temperance Reel and St. Anne's Reel are not going anywhere.
Sure,
Opera
so.
Reel, those tunes are always going to be around.
Yeah.
There'll be certain composed tunes that join the canon of they're always going to be around.
Yeah.
I think of, say, a tune like Dancing Bear.
Yeah.
Or maybe
that's old school now. It's so funny. It's not even that old a tune.
Or Fair Jenny's Jig.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones, hard to say what's going to last. It could be something like Bus Stop. I don't think it's going to be Catharsis because I think it's too hard for some fiddle players.
Flying Home to Shelley.
Flying Home to Shelley probably may stay around. Maison de Glace.
Yeah, another modern tune.
You know, some of the French-Canadian tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it depends, you know, who hands the tune to who hands the tune to whom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing. You think of a Wallace's. Amelia is considered... you know, a traditional tune. It's, of course, it's not. It's a Bob McQuillan tune.
It's not that old, relatively speaking.
Relatively speaking. Larry's, was it Jim and Judy's...
Jim and Judy's Wedding?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Two Rivers, or Choke and Farewell. But then you think about, say, Jay. Think about some of Jay's other tunes. Hoodoo Hoedown. Who plays that? It's a totally cool tune, but it's hard.
Yeah, maybe Vladimir Steamboat.
Yeah.
Is still around there. I don't hear people play it as much anymore.
No.
Yeah, it's interesting. And these tunes are all in the Portland collections now.
Right.
So they're there.
Yeah.
But they tend to kind of fall in and out of...
Right. And Portland Collection has both been a tremendous accomplishment. You know, it's great to have all these tunes in one book. On the other hand, everybody just goes and looks at that book.
Right.
You know, it's like, well, you know, there are a whole lot of other tunes that aren't in here.
Right.
And some of the tunes that are in there, they're slightly idiosyncratic.
And the versions of tunes.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. The versions that are tunes in there. Like, well, that's not how... Like, they got it from the person who submitted to them or chose a version for a particular reason, but there
they
might
did
be...
go back and vet the ones that are composed. They actually... I understand that Sue and Curly did go back and actually ask the composers, is this how this tune goes?
Yeah.
It was very interesting. I had a rehearsal with some people when we were playing Steve Rosen's... Nail That Catfish.
Oh, yeah.
And when we stopped and actually looked at the tune, we realized nobody plays the tune right.
The way he wrote it.
But if, in fact, if you play the tune exactly as written, it's actually even cooler than the way most people play it.
Yeah. So we're losing a little something.
Yeah. So that there. I've actually put in some pushback on, no. Actually go look how it's written.
There's a few versions of, like, Golden Ticket floating around, too, where I feel like they've just lost a little bit of the magic.
Because they filed off a corner that was hard, you know, or it's just they didn't think about it.
Yeah, or exactly. You know, that's how the folk process works. There's sometimes when we've contrified tunes, and I think it makes them better contra tunes. You know, like, there's some Irish tunes that now have contra versions, but it makes them better phrased and easier to play. And, you know, so it's a...
Well, you know, Not Enough Fiddles, we talk about that all the time. You know, if we actually have rehearsals, believe it or not.
And at the rehearsals, I don't believe it.
and at the rehearsals, we actually will look, you know, and sort of say, well, this is how I play it, this is how I play it. Well, let's play it like this.
Yeah.
You know, and that there's reasons why we do it this way, you know, and it's... You know, and it's like even my own playing, I discovered, oh, I always put this chord here. Then someone just pointed out, you know, I know you like that chord, but you know, it just doesn't match. And then when you sit down and you actually listen to what's going on, you go, oh, yeah, you know, I really shouldn't play this
chord. I've done that too. When you're in a band with six fiddles, all of a sudden it matters because they're all trying to harmonize.
Right.
Your role as a piano player is very different.
Right.
Because there's like Josephine's Waltz. I add chords to it that I never thought about. I just always play them. The fiddlers always clash with me on this harmony line in this one part of the tune. It's like all the fiddlers are hearing or remembering this chord, and I don't know what chord they're referring to, but I think of it as something different. You know, it's like that kind of thing happens all the time. Anyway.
So what kind of tunes? All right, so...
So you think there will still be tunes?
There'll be traditional tunes.
Yeah.
There'll be things that we think of as contemporary now will be traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's going to be a whole bunch of tunes that we don't even know of.
Or are they going to be pop songs?
They could be. I mean, look at techno contra, you know, which is contra to EDM.
Yeah.
Or contra to... And techno contras, they fall into two different categories for me, which I don't know that the dancers quantify. Or let me say this a different way. So a lot of the DJs where I've heard of that, some of it sounds very EDM, where they even make up the stuff they do, where, you know, they come up.
You're sequencing everything.
Where they come up with the beats. Others are doing like a DJ mix where they're taking existing club stuff, you know, or not club stuff, you know, and mixing it and contrifying it. And then there's the stuff like you do, which I find a great mystery how you do it, where part of it is you have beats and sequences of stuff that you've developed, but then you play live over top of it.
Yeah.
Which to me is the most which is obviously from my point of view, that's the most interesting sort of stuff because there's a whole improvisatory aspect to it that is not as clear cut as just dancing to a sequence. Now, as in any club DJing, if you have a good person DJing, you know, a techno contra, they may be matching the tunes to the minute. You know, it's to the moment. It's not something they've necessarily cooked up in their house, although I know people who do that too.
Yeah, they just play and go leave the stage.
Yeah, but then other people, you know, are sitting there with, you know, something like a tractor or I forget tractor's one of the programs. Where you load like all the music into slots. It's like
Ableton's really good for that too. Yeah. The tractor is better for some things DJ wise. But yeah, some people are doing live mixing. Some people are doing crossfades live, but they've already worked them out in advance and they're just crossfading live. Some people are writing their own music, less and less of that. You know, my approach was because I wanted to keep, to me, the magic of contra is the relationship between the music and the dancers. Yeah. And I wanted to keep the element. And we tried not playing fiddle tunes and we tried playing fiddle tunes, but people seem to respond to keeping the fiddle tunes in there, you know. I think there's something about a fiddle tune that works really well for a contra dance. Who knew?
Well, I mean, there's absolutely no reason why EDM wouldn't work. I mean, you know, it's all four, you know, a lot of EDM is four on the floor of music. It's
structurally.
But it's not phrased.
Right.
Remember I talk about it, you know, that it's both the beat-to-beat rhythm and then the phrase rhythm. That makes music work for dances.
And there's something about the energy of like, why do you want to do this with a caller telling you what to do? You know, like.
Well, so you don't have to think about it.
Right.
I mean, right. You know, otherwise, how do you know what, if you're a geek like me, how do you know the next thing to do on the dance floor if someone doesn't tell me?
Right. Right.
Oh, yeah, I just stand there and move my feet and wave my arms. I don't know how to do that.
So you think that tunes are going to be around to stay?
The tunes?
Tunes.
Tunes, yes. Tunes will be around to stay.
Yeah.
I have no reason not to think so.
Yeah.
And many reasons to think that will remain true.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to ContraPulse. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit contrapulse.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!